The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Whoa, Lionel, enthusiastic.
Well, back from Belgium. Had a great time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the secret mission. Dun-dun-dun. And Daniel Freeb.
Hello. How's it going?
Hello, Daniel. All right. Less enthusiastic.
Not going with the German pronunciation this week. Anyway.
Freeba. Are you looking forward to the Giro, chaps? It's not long now.
We'll be off in a little over a week's time, won't we, Rich? Amazing.
We will indeed.
Comes around quickly. Indeed. Comes around so quickly, doesn't it?
It really does, doesn't it?
I have to make a short stop at the Giro del Yorkshire first.
Then you fly it to Sicily, Daniel, and join our Giro coverage there. Can we confirm our Giro coverage yet?
Yeah,
more
of
or less.
We can, yeah. Yeah.
All of the big podcasts are confirming this week that they're going to the Giro.
Lance Armstrong will be at the Giro, won't he? Is he going for the whole thing or just Israel?
I think he's just going with Israel. With his pea shooter, he'll be taking aim at you, Rich and Lionel, I'm sure.
The battle of the podcasts, yeah.
Yeah.
Lance. It'd be good to see him again, won't it, Lionel?
Yeah, he's gonna have to he's gonna be outside the ropes, isn't he? Maybe we can smuggle him in. Well,
officially,
we can blow raspberries at him.
Officially, Napalm, I asked the Giro organisation about Armstrong being there today, and they issued the same statement that I think they've since put in the public domain to the effect that he's banned from being accredited at all UCI events, so he can't be accredited, and they also won't be commenting on his presence at the Giro.
I love the fact that Giro have to pretend that they're not really happy that Lance Armstrong is turning up at the Giro.
Well, and Rich, I'd be astonished if at some point during his jaunt to Israel he doesn't go for dinner with the deputy editor of the La Gazzetta dello Sport, also very high up, well, by virtue of that position, very high up in the Giro organisation, Pierre Bergonzi, who's an old chum of Armstrong's.
Well, we're going to talk about the controversial Lance Armstrong, I suspect, briefly later in the episode, aren't we? Because he's been in the news again. But we don't want to give too much publicity to the rival podcast. But before we do any of that, there's been a lot of racing as well. So Lionel, can you give us the news roundup, please?
Yeah, it's a lengthy one this week. A lot going on as the season gears up. Bob Jungels of Quickstep won Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday with a solo break. He got away after the Rochefoucauld climb with about 20 kilometres to go. Chased for a while by Jelle Vanendert of Lotto-Soudal, but Vanendert faded, unable to get across the gap to Jungels. A really impressive win and yet another classic for Quickstep. We'll talk about that in the first couple of parts of today's podcast. Mike Woods, the Canadian rider with EF Education First. I completely missed Daniel describing Mike Woods as American in last week's podcast. I have a golden opportunity to correct Daniel live in the podcast and I completely missed it. But
I'm eating, as we speak, Lionel, I'm eating my big slice of humble pie drizzles with maple syrup.
Well, okay, Lionel, since it's a long intro, I will just interrupt it briefly. We did get a lot of correspondence in this, but this was the one that entertained me the most. Steve Long, dear team, I was shocked, nay appalled, by the flippant attitude of Mr. Daniel Freeb towards the entire dominion of Canada in today's podcast. As a regular listener to the usually excellent body of work, I'm used to Lionel casually dismissing entire small nations.
Oh.
However, as if to lump Canada in with our noisy southern neighbours in the use of the word scallions isn't bad enough, he then proceeds to attempt to publicly humiliate Michael Woods by calling him American. Outrageous. So there we've upset America now. A rudimentary Wikipedia such as show he was born in our nation's capital, which for Mr. Freeb's information, is Ottawa. Note, not Washington.
It did strike me that all of my good predictions, there aren't many, it isn't often that I make good predictions, but they're always ill-fated in some way. So I predicted that Mike Woods would win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He finished second, but then I stuffed it up by calling him American. Very much like my infamous, now infamous, Lilian Calmejean prediction at last year's Tour de France. Predicted that he was going to win a stage, predicted the right stage, and then it was cut from my copy at Pro Cycling Magazine.
So you see. Anyway, sorry, anyway, Lionel. That was from Steve Long, that letter, by the way.
Well, good old Steve Long. I mean, Daniel spent all week apologising for this, but Mike Woods was really impressive. Second place, out-sprinted Romain Bardet at the line in Anse. Julian Alaphilippe of Quickstep was fourth. An awful lot to unpick from Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which we will do in a little bit. Anna van der Breggen completed the Ardennes double in the women's race and won her fourth World Tour Classic of the spring. She's already won Strade Bianche, the Tour of Flanders, Flèche Wallonne, and now her second Liège-Bastogne-Liège in a row. Amanda Spratt and Annemiek van Vleuten, Mitchelton Scott teammates, took second and third. But the Bols Dolmans rider has been head and shoulders above the rest this year. Sticking with Bols Dolmans, a story that came out shortly after we recorded the podcast last week. News that their mechanic, Richard Steger, had suffered a heart attack at the team's hotel after the Amstel Gold Race last Sunday. And Team Sky's Dave Brailsford and particularly their medical staff were very quickly to... they acted very quickly to resuscitate Steger, and he was taken to hospital where he is said to be recovering well. Another result from women's cycling that caught my eye as I was doing my research for the news this week. A rider, Marianne Hinault, won the Challenge Bretagne. Okay, it's only a small race and she's a junior rider, but it's a senior race, so it's an impressive win. Marianne Hinault, a very famous name, means a lot in the world of cycling, of course. No relation to Bernard Hinault, but she is the daughter of former professional and Fortuneo director sportif Sébastien Hinault. So one to watch. Maybe you can follow up on that in the cycling podcast Féminin, Richard.
Well, a podcast Féminin is going to be coming out at about the same time as this episode. So lots in there, including an interview with Amanda Spratt and Ashley Moulman-Passio.
Sticking with women's racing briefly, Marianne Vos crashed and fractured her collarbone at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. She's had an operation and will be out of action for about a month. In the men's racing, the Tour of the Alps has concluded. Thibaut Pinot won that. He's warming up for the Giro very nicely. Fourth last year, of course, and will go into the race as Groupama's leader. Sticking with Italy, Austria, Italy. This is definitely Italy. Giulio Ciccone won the Giro del Apennino one-day race. People may remember Ciccone from a couple of years ago at the Giro. He rides for Bardiani CSF, and he won the medium mountain stage at Sestola a couple of years ago. He's still only 23 and will likely lead Bardiani at this year's Giro. Hopefully they will have a more... encouraging race. I was going to say more positive race than last year, but they don't want a more positive race than last year.
Very positive. Extremely positive. Yeah. Last year, wasn't it?
On the eve of the race, two of their riders, it was announced, had tested positive and were kicked out of the race. Finally, for the racing, Bahrain Merida's Konstantin Siutsu has won the Tour of Croatia. A couple of bits of news from off the bike, which we'll also talk about a little bit later. Lance Armstrong has settled his $100 million federal fraud case with the US government for $5 million. That was due to go to court next month, but has been settled. Floyd Landis reportedly gets a whistleblower's payment of more than $1 million for, blowing the lid on the whole thing. The reason for this case was it was basically a federal fraud case because the team that Armstrong rode for was sponsored by a federal agency, the United States Postal Service. But it does strike me that settling for $5 million instead of $100 million, it's a bit like losing a minute on a mountain stage after getting dropped 7 kilometres from the top of the last climb. So we'll talk about Mr. Armstrong a bit later on. And finally, some sad news. Andy Reith, who was the man behind BMC Racing for many years, died age 75, reportedly from leukemia. We will talk about Andy Reith and his legacy in the third part of the podcast. But yeah, a busy week.
Thank you very much indeed to our main sponsor, Rafa. And this week's Rafa shout-out is actually about a ride that you and I are doing, Lionel. It's a Rafa company ride.
I know.
Tomorrow.
I know. It goes through my home village of Rockford. So they literally couldn't not invite me. Is that right?
They couldn't not invite you. And they did not invite you. But I got you... involved. Only joking. But it should be a big day out. There's very varied ride distances. I'll not reveal on air the distance we're riding. Might reveal that next week. But lots of people, and it'll finish in a pub for a pub lunch. So looking forward to that.
Wonderful.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
The final monument of the spring, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, dominates the racing news, I suppose. And, you know, we produced a French special last week, The Trouble with La Doyenne. We've had some very interesting correspondence on that as well. And a shout out in particular to, if you'll excuse me one second, I'm just looking up his name. Adrian Walters wrote us a very, very long and very interesting email. And we'll maybe try and share some of that at some point. But we produced an episode which was called The Trouble with La Doyenne. And it was highlighting some of the problems with the race, I suppose, that seem to become quite formulaic and predictable, in the sense that Alejandro Valverde has been almost unbeatable on that that final climb up to the finish in Anse. Different script this year, with Bob Jungels going clear much earlier, and a real coming-of-age win for him. He's been such a gradually developing talent. Very impressive, really, the way that he's just improved a little bit year on year, missing the Giro this year, during that last couple of years. But yeah, Alejandro Coconut finally beaten. Alejandro Coconut. That's just continuing last week's theme of vegetable names. We're Simon Spielak riding well in the Tour de Romandie at the moment. Simon Spring Onion, because he comes into season in time for the Tour of Switzerland. Alejandro Coconut, because he's basically in season all year round, and quite a similar hairstyle.
Well, he has got a similar hairstyle to a coconut, kind of sort of wispy flyaway. I'm allowed to say that because I obviously I'm not even a coconut. I'm some kind of egg,
a mango.
But a little bit. I mean, a coconut's not a vegetable, though, is it? It's a nut.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter for the purposes of the joke. Alejandro Coconut finally beaten and didn't. We did talk last week about the smaller team sizes, and he did appear quite isolated quite early, and so had to do quite a lot himself. And, you know, Sean Kelly called it on the commentary that there was a point in the race where Enric Mas was really doing a lot of work for Quickstep. They had quite a few bodies there. And he said, here, Quickstep are going to play the numbers game, which they've done in so many races. And they did, because Alaphilippe, of course, was a very dangerous rider behind. He'd won Flesh Wallonne, and that was part of the reason why Bob Jungels was able to get away and stay away, but it also was a very impressive ride from him.
We've seen four monuments now this season, Rich, and every one has been won by a long-range solo attack, and we've mentioned and debated to a certain extent whether the smaller teams this year, so seven-man teams in the classics, is having an effect as opposed to eight in previous years. And this might be one symptom of that, that when the time comes to organise a chase, the teams behind and the riders behind simply don't have they don't have the teammates that they need to organise a chase. And there are an awful lot of different teams represented in the chase group behind Jungels. But in certain circumstances, you can get situations where there are almost too many teams, because, you know, there are so many different permutations in each of the riders' heads. You know, oh, well, if we catch him, then there's that guy who's faster than me in a sprint, or that guy who's going to drop me on the final climb, that it almost becomes counterproductive. And it seemed to me that that was almost the case. But again, it was this theme that we've talked about before, of hesitation, and there was a lot of hesitation. There was also Alaphilippe, who was playing the perfect policeman's role and was strong enough to do so. You know, usually if you've only got one rider there who's able to follow the moves on behalf of a teammate, then eventually he'll crack after the third or fourth attempt at a counterattack. Alaphilippe was so strong that he was going with everyone.
Well, your quick step really, I mean, they played it exactly the same way that Nicky Terpstra won the Tour of Flanders, really. I mean, it was quite surreal just how similar it was. And people, this is not my point, really. I saw somebody say on Twitter that, you know, it's as if the Ardennes Classics riders hadn't watched the Cobble Classics and weren't aware that if a Quickstep rider makes a move like that, then really it has to be shut down pretty much straight away for exactly that reason that they had Julian Alaphilippe and Philippe Gilbert in the group behind. I mean, Gilbert made a few kind of teasing moves, maybe 7 or 8 kilometres before Jungels went. But it was the numbers behind was interesting because Astana had a couple of riders, Sunweb had a couple of riders, Mitchelton Scott had a couple of riders, Lotto Soudal had a couple of riders, and they all sort of, you know, they didn't really fully commit to, you know, an actual chase. Michael Valgren of Astana did a lot of work on the front, and, you know, it was basically one against one for a while. Van Aert had tried to bridge across to Jungels for Lotto Soudal, which, you know, that was a smart thing to do probably with Tim Wellens still in the group. But you know, Sam Ooman and Tom Dumoulin there for Sunweb, and they didn't really get it, you know, get it under control or contribute anything. They kind of both followed along, and I just wondered whether, you know, I mean, it's so hard in a group of what, 17, 18 riders as it was at that time, so hard for them to kind of all, you know, align and think, well, if we all do this and if we all join forces, it doesn't really work like that. It's not like a computer game where they can all, you know, just sort of move to the front. Nobody's quite sure how strong everybody else is, and nobody wants to do the work to that somebody else then profits from. You know, at the end of the day, Jungels had made that move, and you know, it was likely that the only way to bring him back was somebody trying what Jelle Van Aert did, which is get across to him, and then maybe one or two others would go across as well, rather than that whole group coming back up to him.
Sorry, Napalm, you mentioned Van Aert. What an extraordinary rider he is, in the sense that he's had a couple of days in his career when he's looked like the best rider in the world. There was the Stade de Plateau de Bay in the 2011 Tour de France. And then again, on Sunday, he looked like the strongest climber in the race, certainly going up San Nicola. And it's difficult to reconcile with a guy who has had whose palmarès is pretty threadbare. You know, he's done fairly well in the Ardennes before, but never really threatened to win a big classic, or never really threatened to finish in the top five of a major tour. I expect to see him going well in the Giro coming up. I notice he's on the start list for that. But yes, yeah, a strange and very streaky career.
Van Aert and Tim Wellens had a bit of bad words, didn't they, after Flèche Wallonne? Wellens felt that Van Aert hadn't helped him as obviously he felt he was supposed to. And I noticed they're both riding the Giro, so that'll be a fun 3 weeks on Lotto Soudal. Jungels, though, his attack showed great persistence, I thought, because he had a go on the climb, and then it was going over the top. In fact, I read Mike Wood saying that it was him that let the wheel go, and it was very much that sort of attack when he eventually got clear. It wasn't really an attack. It was just persistence on the front, which I thought was, you know, it didn't look dangerous, really, when he slipped away. And it took a rider of his sort of class and with his time-travelling ability to really press home the advantage.
So often the way, isn't it, after the difficulty and as mm-hmm. the sort of the climb turns to false flat, that's where certainly a strong time trialist is at an advantage, you know, can get on top of a bigger gear quicker perhaps and get it rolling, get it going. And you know, Mike Woods is you know, much more of a climber, and that's where he's likely to be vulnerable when the power suddenly goes on a less steep bit or on a false flat section. So yeah, it was another sort of ghostly move, a little bit like the way that we see the moves so often go after cobbled climbs or after cobbled sections in the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. It's the same theory, really. The climbs are not the place where you see, you know, decisive accelerations that split everything up. They're the bit that make it difficult. They're the bit that make it hard to stay on the wheels and keep the gaps from opening up once they've gone over the top. So yeah, it was a first class move from Jungels, and I mean, I didn't really see that coming from him there, because I suppose, having seen him ride round two successive editions of the Giro d'Italia in the top 10, he had a stage win last year, pink jersey the year before. Had him down as a bit more of a sort of a diesel, I guess, rather than a rider that would be suited to that, you know, right at the end of a very long, very hard race.
And you mentioned, Lionel, about the timing of the attack there. That's another theme we've visited several times in this spring, this idea of the attacks coming just before or just after, you know, the spot where you would usually expect them to go. So Nibali's early attack on the Poggio, Terpstra in the Tour of Flanders going on a fairly benign section, and then Sagan going away on the asphalt, didn't he, on the tarmac at Paris-Roubaix. And then again, and Jungels, like you say, he wasn't someone that would have been considered among the, you know, necessarily among the likely protagonists in the Ardennes, although, you know, he's a very good and well-rounded rider. I mean, I noticed him at the Brabantse Pale, the first instalment, really, of the Ardennes Classics, and he really was struggling on that final rise up to the finish that concludes that race, and he didn't look in particularly good form. But then we did mention him after Flèche Wallonne, what a brilliant job he'd done at the bottom of the Mur de Huy. So he obviously timed his sort of form peak perfectly, and he's definitely a guy who, if you look at the way that the sort of the Tour de France field is shaping up, and guys possibly falling by the wayside, question marks over Froome, he's someone who's going to be a real threat in the Tour de France. He doesn't have any real experience of leading a big team at the Tour, and there isn't a lot of time trialing on the Tour route, but nevertheless, I think he could surprise a few people.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This week's episode sponsor is The Economist magazine. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, arts and the environment. It helps prepare readers for what is going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence. It helps people like you, that's you the listener, choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. If you're a cycling podcast listener, you can get a free copy of The Economist if you go to economist.com/cycling. Lionel, what have you read in The Economist this week?
Well, I've got the online subscription and I found myself clicking on 1843, which is the Economist kind of lifestyle magazine section. It's subtitled The Economist Unwinds. 1843 is the year that The Economist was founded. But the feature that caught my eye, you won't be surprised to know, it was connected to food. It's by a journalist called Tara Isabella Burton, and it was What 24 Hours in a Diner Taught Me About New York. And basically, she spent 24 hours in a New York diner observing who came and went. And I suppose the reason that chimed with me and I enjoyed reading that was because I do that very much when we're covering the Grand Tours over our evening meal, the fact that we're in a different place each night in a different restaurant, and you learn something about the place from your surroundings and from the people and from the food and all of that. So that was something that kind of ticked the boxes for me.
Well, a couple of articles caught my eye. One relates also loosely to what we do, and it's an article about learning languages and about how some languages are more difficult than others to learn. You'll appreciate this, Lionel, having attempted to learn Italian last year. How's that going, by the way?
Well, I'm still doing it, but I mean, I'm so intimidated by Daniel's Italian that I barely gave it a run out last year. I'm hoping to have a little bit more of a go this time.
Well, apparently, learning Spanish, Swedish or French, their Category 1 languages, takes 575 to 600 class hours. It doesn't sound that much, I must say, and it makes me feel pretty bad about my efforts. But some of the other languages, Category 3, Arabic, Japanese, Mandarin, 2,200 class hours, so that's quite an undertaking. If you want your free copy of The Economist, go to economist.com/cycling. That's economist.com/cycling. So other takeaways from Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I mean, you mentioned Bob Jungels doing a good job in Flèche Wallonne last Wednesday. Just came back to my mind, him at Flèche Wallonne last year. In fact, he was away on his own, a similar sort of move, and had a gap about 30-40 seconds at one point, and it did look at one point as though he might have enough on the Mur de Huy. Didn't work out like that, but there was a sign there of, you know, his capabilities in these sorts of races, and a great win for him. Continues Quick Step's amazing streak any other takeaways from you guys? I mean, Mike Woods in second, coming to form nicely for the Giro. He's had a bit of illness this year, but looks in very good shape. And Romain Bardet was up there with him as well.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Woods is, considering how long he's been riding at this level, that was, you know, really impressive performance. And bearing in mind, he was seventh in the Vuelta last year, and you know, he really is in exactly the place he would want to be going into the Giro. So I think without over hyping him, I think he's somebody he could genuinely aim for the podium in the Giro. As for Romain Bardet, his performances in one-day races this year has been really impressive. You know, he could quite easily just concentrate on the stage races and just build towards the Tour de France, but he's been mixing it up, you know, in the one-day races as well and seizing the opportunity. Okay, a couple of those races have been the sort of smaller French races. He's won the Classic d'Ardèche and was second at the Tour de Finistère, but second at Strade Bianche as well, and third in a race as hard as Liège-Bastogne-Liège. It's interesting to see him riding like that and seizing those opportunities. And it makes you wonder whether there's something in the back of his mind about that Paris-Roubaix stage on at the end of the first week of the Tour de France, you know, because it's going to be almost like a one-day race. That there's not going to be an awful lot of opportunity to be protected by teammates. Obviously, you know, there'll be some of that in the early sections, but it really will be every man for himself. And perhaps he's just, you know, honing those kind of skills, getting out front and going on the offensive rather than being on the back foot.
A few disappointments. I mean, I think we expected more from Vincenzo Nibali on the day. Dan Martin, we were maybe a bit unkind to Dan Martin in last week's podcast. We felt he was off the pace at Flèche Wallonne. He had problems at Flèche Wallonne, and so that's why he was off the back chasing. I thought it was a real statement from him putting his team on the front for quite a lot of the race on Sunday. And again, though, bad luck. He had a puncture towards the end, and he'd been attacking a lot before then, and you could see how frustrated he was. I also wanted to mention Tim Wellens as well. I thought Tim Wellens looked very strong, but again, tactically, he rides in a strange way sometimes. He was, well, when Dan Martin was attacking, it was often Tim Wellens chasing him down. And for what? I couldn't really figure it out. Almost like he was just trying to break everybody through sheer strength. But a strong rider who doesn't often ride all that tactically sensibly, it seems.
Also, Rich, he's one of those guys who, you know, Napalm said earlier that Jungels kind of ghosted off the front, and that is often the way winning moves go. That people go away in such a way that it doesn't sort of set everyone's alarm bells ringing. And Tim Wellens is someone who always attacks off the front with all guns blazing, and it almost immediately, inevitably prompts a sort of emergency response in the group behind, and they're much more inclined to chase after him because of the way he attacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Dan Martin, I mean, I don't know whether we were unkind or unfair, but I mean, his results this season have not suggested that he was going to win Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I mean, didn't finish Paris-Nice on the last day. He was fairly low down in the Tour of Catalonia. Didn't finish Amstel Gold last week. Like you say, had problems at Flèche Wallonne. But if putting the UAE team on the front, you know, they bossed completely the wrong part of the race. If you're trying to win, they were on the front for the wrong part. I mean, there was no need to do all of that work at that particular time. Admittedly, Dan Martin made a couple of strong-looking moves. You know, he got off the front a couple of times. But, you know, after the third time, I did wonder whether he would have anything left for the finale, because, you know, he'd made a considerable amount of effort. And then, of course, the front wheel puncture meant that we didn't get to find out what he had left. But there were some interesting tactical moves. I mean, Bahrain Merida as well, they did a lot of work. At one point, they had both these Aguirre brothers. They had Gasparotto and Visconti on the front. And
Gasparagus
on the front. In season for a week, and then rapidly out of season, and sort of
he's all green now and kind of and slightly bitter taste,
bruised, and everyone's walking past him in the supermarket aisle. Anyway, but I thought that was a precursor for a Nibali move. But you know, if he was going to go, he probably would have needed to go around about the point where Jungels went, and by that time, you know, he was sort of drifting towards the back. in terms of, you know, the last 20K were really absorbing to watch, weren't they? But up until that point, it had been a very, very slow burn of a race. I mean, nothing of any note happened on La Redoute, for example. So while we'd released our special episode, The Trouble with La Doyenne, I was sort of wincing at the prospect of an absolute humdinger of a race to prove us all wrong. But, you know, I think it's just proof, once again, that the race is so hard that... you know, the window of opportunity for somebody to make some kind of move is in the very end stages, and I think
we love Milan San Remo, and we watch that with the expectation that nothing will happen until the end, and it's all about the anticipation of that.
Very true.
I've seen a few comments from people suggesting that, you know, there wasn't an awful lot to shout about other than it being a good winner. But I did find it an intriguing race, and to see Valverde closing gaps, you know, quite early on. And I just thought I enjoyed it. And I, you know, there were lots of elements to it that seemed to me to be lots of riders who thought they could win it. And I mentioned earlier on the email we've had from Adrian Walters, and, you know, he went with some friends and they rode the Sportif, and he's just written to say in a lot of detail what a great day they had and what a great race it was to watch. So that's, you know, they had a fantastic experience there. And he's offering what he says is a bit of a contrast to maybe the tone of our special, which was it was highlighting what we perceived to be some of the problems with Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I'm not suggesting that that none of those problems still exist, but I did enjoy watching it. I must admit, I was absorbed.
Well, I was going to say the last 20K were as entertaining as anything I've seen this season, because there was a lot going on. There was, the hesitation when Jungels went, and the moments when Valverde looked good and then suddenly didn't, and the questions about who was going to take up the chase, and the fact that they left one poor Astana rider to do it all on his own. And you could tell just from the TV pictures that one against one, that gap was never going to come back. And in fact, Jungels was stretching it out because he was absolutely committed to the move. And it was, in hindsight, it was not just... entertaining to watch, but it was cleverly thought out. And what a luxurious position Quickstep have found themselves in all spring, really, because they've always had somebody of such strength sitting in the group behind who just frightens everybody else off, trying to close down the gaps in ones and twos, because they know they'll just be dragging another Quickstep across.
Well, their domination this spring has been quite something, Lionel. Mappe were the team at the end of the 90s who were famous for their domination of spring seasons. But if you just do a quick comparison, I think Quickstep's 2018 spring really outstrips almost anything that Mappe produced. In 98, Mappe won the Doise d'Or Vlaanderen, E3 Hauerbecker, Gent Wevelgem, the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, and Flesh Brabanson, or Brabant's Appeal. This year, I think that was probably their best. 2018, Quickstep won Doise d'Or Vlaanderen, E3, Tour of Flanders, Scheldeprijs, Price, Flèche Wallonne, Liège, and they've also won Le Samin, Nocera Cursa, Hanzame Classic, and the now one-day race, 3 days of Depana. So I would suggest it's almost unprecedented. All the more remarkable when Mappe were famous and famously accused of sort of doping the market back in those days, in the same way that Team Sky have been accused of doping the market in stage races. What does that mean? Well, Mappe simply had a huge amount of money invested in their classics team, which absolutely dwarfed the amount that rival teams were investing. Sky have a huge budget as well. We don't think that Quickstep have the biggest budget in the pro peloton. In fact, we're sure they don't. So the secret must be somewhere else, and it will. I think their domination, or the domination of any team in cycling, always makes people slightly uneasy. But that's about all we can say. Quickstep do have a couple of people on their books, on their staff, with fairly, I wouldn't say colourful past, but who have been accused of connections with doping in the past. So Dr. Van Mol, but Dr. Van Mol won a court case against Het Laatste Nieuws, a Belgian newspaper who accused him of effectively betting doping. He had €100,000 payout in 2009 when he won that case. There have been other allegations, but he's generally well, he has come through those with his reputation intact. But as I say, by definition and the history of professional cycling is such that the domination of any team, particularly when it's not by far the richest team in the world, will always make people slightly suspicious. But then at the same time, you know, you get Mike Woods finishing second and he's the best of the rest against Bob Jungels. And Mike Woods is someone who, you know, last year, for example, when he spoke to us for our book, was more outspoken against doping and previously convicted dopers than almost anyone we've ever heard. So I don't think there was anything necessarily alarming in Jungels' performance.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you mentioned Van Mol. Van Mol, I suppose, you know, the context to this discussion is that a lot of people on the Quickstep team and on the staff and so on have been around for years and have lived through all the various eras in cycling, including, you know, the man at the top, Patrick Lefebvre. But Van Mol, the doctor, has been a cycling doctor since the 80s. And he famously was the doctor on Greg LeMond's team ADR in 1989 when LeMond was really struggling to come back from being shot in 1987. And towards the end of the Giro that year, Van Mol administered some shots of iron to Greg LeMond. And LeMond came round and finished, I think, second in the time trial, didn't he, at the Giro, and obviously went on to win the Tour de France. So Van Mol's been around forever. He's a keen art collector. He's a very good friend of Geert Leinders, who was the Team Sky doctor briefly, and before that the Rabobank doctor, and obviously a controversial figure. And I think that's the, you know, that's one of the issues, and it's not just about Quickstep. It's in a lot of teams that a lot of people involved have been around a long time and have lived through, you know, all the various eras in cycling.
Absolutely, Rich. And he has been the subject of a few or various allegations. I mean, his name was mentioned in the Conconi, the Donati dossier, the infamous dossier. I won't go into detail about what that contained, but it was one of the first real acts of whistleblowing in cycling in the 1990s. But again, nothing really stuck there. And the other issue with Van Mol is that he's incredibly prominent. He's quite a distinctive looking gentleman with a little moustache, and I would guess he's in his 60s now, but you will pretty much always see him in fairly close attendance where you see Patrick Lefebvre, the Quickstep team boss. And he's also very influential in strategic choices that take place in the team. Patrick Lefebvre has made no bones about this, that he will pretty much always ask Van Mol's opinion when he's weighing up whether to sign a rider or not, which I guess is quite unusual in professional cycling teams.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Okay, our question this week is a fascinating one. It's from Stephen Hodge. Hi guys, always suitably entertained by your show. Thank you, Stephen. Wondered if Science and Sport could shed some light on as to why, if I have fish and chips the night before a big ride or event or a race, that I ride so much better the next day compared to if I have something more what you would assume to be suitable, such as a rice dish. As always, great show, and thanks for entertaining me during my day. Thank you, Stephen.
That's a really interesting question, and I suppose I can only guess at the exact mechanisms involved in your fish and chip fueled performance. But one thing I would say is the fish and chips provide protein, and they provide carbs, and they provide fat. So the protein potentially could help a bit of muscle recovery. The carbs will obviously help with some fueling, and the fat that's in the batter isn't of the best nutritional value, but again, it does provide some fuel. So it may be that simply by consuming the fish and chips, you're actually providing your body with more calories than you consumed when you had a rice meal. I think if we had a rice meal with some high quality protein with the same number of calories in, I'd expect you to outperform fish and chips.
Well, we heard there this week's question to Dr. Rob Child at Science Sport. He's Chief Scientific Officer there. Quite an entertaining one this week about fish and chips. That wasn't you that wrote that in, was it, Lionel?
No, although I do enjoy fish and chips, and I've got a big ride tomorrow.
There's a surprise. There's a scoop. Mm.
No, it was Stephen Hodge that wrote in. Thank you, Stephen, for your letter. If you want to write in with a nutrition question, either for yourself or about the pros, and we'll get some of the pros to answer, do email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And thank you once again, Science and Sport, for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. So in this final part of this week's podcast, the last one before the Giro preview podcast, we've got quite a lot to pack into this final part. You know, bits of news from the last week. First of all, the very sad news about Andy Rees, who been involved for quite some time running Phonak team initially, regularly described as a Swiss billionaire, and more recently BMC. I mean, the Phonak experience ended pretty badly with Floyd Landis's positive test at the 2006 Tour de France for testosterone. But Andy Rees was undeterred, and he came back initially with a development team in America, BMC, which came to Europe in 2010, same time as Team Sky. And coincidentally, those two teams, Sky and BMC, have both been accused, I suppose, of inflating the market in terms of riders' salaries and so on. BMC famously paid big, big money to riders like Philippe Gilbert, who arguably didn't deliver all that much in return. They did win the Tour de France in 2011 with Cadel Evans. That will be the high watermark, really, I suppose, for BMC. And as well as the Evans Tour de France win, I suppose Greg Van Avermaet last year winning Paris-Roubaix was another of the great successes of BMC under Andy Rees. They have been looking for a sponsor to take over. There were rumours that this would be BMC's last year. Don't know how the future of the team will be affected by Andy Rees's death. It was obviously a project that was very close to his heart. We used to see him at a lot of races. I mean, he was a sort of avuncular figure with his white beard and no pretensions at all about him as far as I could make out. He often, you know, was wearing BMC team issue gear. He didn't look like a billionaire. I don't really know what a billionaire looks like. But he was a fairly approachable guy. And the only time I saw him get prickly was when you asked him about Floyd Landis and the Tour de France in 2006, and he didn't particularly like talking about that, but he was otherwise quite an approachable chap.
I think, Rich, that's what everyone has emphasised in the day since his death, just how unpretentious he was. I've just been reading some of the Swiss newspapers and their obituaries this week, people talking about how highly unusual it was for someone of his stature to always rigorously with everyone use the du rather than the z form, so the polite German word when he met someone, sort of friendly way of greeting everyone. Stefan Kung, the Swiss BMC rider, told a nice story in one of the newspapers about how he'd bumped into Rees on a flight just after he'd signed for BMC's development team. Rees recognized him and congratulated him on joining the team, and then he took out a pile of cycling magazines that he had in his bag that he used to carry around, a pile of cycling magazines everywhere he went, and he offered Kung won for the flight as reading material. He was that passionate about cycling, was wanting to know absolutely everything that was going on. He and his brother were also became the owners of the major Swiss football team, Young Boys of Bern. Young Boys of Bern. Yeah, that's correct. Sorry. a bit of a tongue twister. And we put a huge amount of money in there as well, estimated to be over sort of 50 million Swiss francs he put into Young Boys of Bern, 20 million Swiss francs a year he was putting in at BMC. And yeah, obviously leaves that team with a bit of a question mark over their future. Again, in the Swiss press there, it has been reported that Tag Heuer, who became a sub-sponsor a couple of years ago, they might possibly be interested in stepping up, but they have a contract which currently runs until 2019. And they've already said that they want to continue on that deal, so they don't want to up their engagement. And then there's another sponsor that BMC has got on board in the last couple of years, Sophos, which I think is a software security company. They're another possibility, but the months are obviously ticking by, and I think most of the riders are going to listen to or see what BMC are able to come up with before about June, and then they'll have to explore other options.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Richie mentioned about the Phonak team, which was Andy Reese's first foray into cycling. Shouldn't really forget either that he signed Tyler Hamilton, and Hamilton won the 2004 Olympic Games time trial in a stage of the Vuelta. And then both he and Santiago Perez, another Fornek rider, tested positive for banned blood transfusions. And that was the sort of the big doping scandal of that year, wasn't it, 2004? And then 2 years later, of course, Floyd Landis riding to victory in a Fonac jersey and on a BMC bicycle at the Tour de France, stripped of his title, and that title passed to Oscar Pereiro, who had just spent 3 years riding for the Fonac team before joining Castapan. So I'm not surprised that Rhys, was prickly about talking about that tour in 2006. But, you know, it clearly bankrolled the BMC team as well, and, you know, went much bigger in terms of the stature of the riders that he signed. You mentioned Cadel Evans, but they also signed Tor Hushov, Philippe Gilbert, who one was already a world champion, one became a world champion while with BMC. And I read once, I never quite sort of managed to get to the bottom of this because Swiss accounts and so on are quite opaque. But there were reports that the BMC team's budget was actually bigger than the bike company's turnover, which suggests that it was, you know, almost entirely bankrolled by Andy Rees as his kind of project. So he certainly put a lot of his money as well as his passion and heart into cycling. And certainly the BMC part of his legacy looks an awful lot healthier than the Fonec part of it.
In a cycling context, yeah. I mean, yeah, the 2006 tour was really disastrous for that team. And they were due to be taken over by a new sponsor, iShares, a subsidiary of Barclays. And that obviously went south after Landis lost his title. So, you know, the remarkable thing is that Rhys was back so soon after that. You'd have thought a guy like that with his wealth and status didn't need that, but he, as Daniel's story about the cycling magazine shows, the sense he had was that he just had this incredible passion for the sport, and he funded a velodrome in Switzerland as well, so a real benefactor for cycling in Switzerland. Very sad that he has died, of course, and it makes the uncertainty around Team BMC and their future, I suppose, all the deeper. And they're not having a great season either. Their big riders haven't really performed yet this year, so we'll watch what happens there over the next few weeks and months.
I spoke to Max Chiandri on the phone. He's one of the sports directors at BMC Racing, has been for a number of years, and I spoke to him about the team losing Andy Rees.
You know, a great man for cycling. He really loved and cared for bike riders. His philosophy was never about winning, but having fun and being happy, kind of. That's what he always said, you know. And I think it was a great man. And we saw him in the Dania, the training camp in January, and you know, he looked weak, but he made the big effort to come over and see everybody.
What, you've been in the team a long time, so I mean, did you get to know him a little bit?
No, I got to know him quite well. I mean, he used to come in a regular basis to the camps. At least he always used to come to training camps. I used to see him in when I did Swiss or Romandy was his race. Tour de France, he used to come. He used to have this Vino Veritas. Vino Veritas was a ride he used to put together with a bunch of friends, and used to ride either through Corsica, Sardinia, and one year he did it in Tuscany, and I helped him organize routes. So what he used to do, he used to ride in the morning, you know, with a support team around him, just ride and then stop, and it's all about, you know, sitting at a table with friends and eating and drinking, you know, having good wine, and just enjoying life, you know, enjoying the cycling part of it, enjoying life. So we did one year through Tuscany. He did a bit of the roads of Tiveno. And, yeah, that's a memory, you know. It's not that, you know, as a sponsor, you didn't really see him that much, but, you know, they saw him in the good occasions. I remember when he was building the track in when I first got on the job, he was building the track in Grand Canyon, and a lot was about you know, me coming off of BC and having a lot of not expertise, because I wasn't involved in BC on the track, but you know, I came, I had a bit of expertise on the track, and some was like, we talked about it, and he's like, you should take care of the track, you should look into it. Like, one time, you're here on the road now, look after the road. But I remember he was building that track in Grenke, he's very proud of it. He liked it.
And lastly, what kind of impact do you think it will have on the team in the short term, you know, in the next few weeks with the Giro coming up, but also at the end of the season? Do you know?
I think everybody's going to... Everybody's got Andy in his mind, and you know, and I have kind of been riding in these few days. I haven't done the classics, and I've been home, and I've been riding, and I really want to give a good motivational speech to the guy to really give him something. You know, I mean, he gave a lot to us and supporting this team for many years, and I want everybody to give him the best, to reward him and make the best out of what Andy would have liked. It was some good bike racing, you know. I mean, good to see that in the front and do stuff, you know. So I'm going to go to the Giro. He's going to be in our minds and really try and give him the best from the riders to the staff to myself.
So another bit of news this week that we mentioned earlier, Lance Armstrong. Remember him? He has settled his case out of court with the US government. He'll pay $5 million. Floyd Landis will pocket over $1 million of that. Nice work if you can get it. And we're deprived of a court case that would have, I guess, laid bare yet more of cycling's dark secrets. Are you surprised, Daniel? Surprised that, you know, that this has been hanging over Armstrong for a few years and threatened to financially ruin him? I guess $5 million, it's not exactly small change, but you know, it's a good outcome for Armstrong, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is a good outcome for him, primarily because he can now, well, put all of his legal worries to bed. This one was obviously the big one. This was the one which could potentially have wiped out his whole fortune. The case itself is quite difficult from a British or European perspective to wrap your head around. Floyd Landis bringing a case against Lance Armstrong that could potentially cost him $100 million. But as far as, you know, do I feel he got off lightly? Has justice been done? The scars and the ignominy and the sort of disgrace that Lance Armstrong sort of, well, brought upon himself and brought upon the sport is something that he's had to live with and will continue to have to live with, regardless of any financial penalties that he has to pay. You know, there is a school of thought that why should he live the rest of his days in great financial comfort? You would imagine he's still able to live in. While there are a litany, or some would have you believe a litany of victims, people who didn't have the career that they should have had, or whose career was in some way affected by Armstrong's doping. I actually think that's a pretty small number of people when we consider the context of the time. We know how prevalent EPO doping and blood transfusions and so forth were at the time of Armstrong's reign. And as I think I said on our tour recently, Rich, sometimes it bothers me slightly when certain names are used, I think, in vain. People like Christophe Basson, people say that Christophe Basson's life was ruined. Christophe Basson was the French rider who was effectively bullied out of the Tour de France in 1999 by Armstrong. I mean, what I said about Armstrong having to bear the ignominy for the rest of his life, well, in a similar fashion, Christophe Basson has never, you know, he's never had to bear any kind of bitterness or resentment or regret, because that's simply not the way he lives his life. He doesn't compute his success in material terms or in terms of, you know, what he did or didn't achieve as a bike rider. And you know, if you speak to Christophe now, he considers himself very lucky because of that, but he certainly doesn't bear any malice towards Armstrong. His life has just turned out a little bit differently to the way it perhaps would.
Yeah, I've seen some comments about Armstrong saying, oh, well, you know, cheating pays, you know, he got away with it. I mean, we shouldn't forget that he has been stripped of his Tour de France titles. You know, he hasn't got away with it. He perhaps has more money than some people are comfortable with, or a lot of people are comfortable with, but he's no longer a seven-time Tour de France winner. That, you know, the record books show that, and whether you agree with that or not, that's the real punishment, isn't it? I mean, that's the sporting punishment that he deserves on account of his doping.
It is, Rich. And
cheating.
Well, and the kind of ignominy that I talked about, that is also manifested in sort of material terms, in the sense that you know, he can't go to the Giro d'Italia and can't get accredited, and that's got to be highly embarrassing, and, you know, even suggest humiliating for Armstrong.
I think it's hypocritical, really, of the sport when some dopers are allowed to be accredited either in a media capacity or in a VIP capacity, or even as sort of ambassadors for events or sponsors, or working on teams. And Lance Armstrong can't. I mean, yeah, he was the most successful doper, in the sense that he got the greatest riches and the greatest rewards. But, you know, look back at that era and, you know, even at the time, I don't think that Lance Armstrong was operating on a completely different planet to, you know, the people who were second, third, fourth and so on in the tours that he won. And I also think that the federal case was a slightly strange one from the start, because the US Postal Service had an opportunity to reappraise its sponsorship of the team, you know, midway through. And there were numerous allegations and stories that had come out that ended up being part of the whole jigsaw. And if they'd, you know, without mixing my metaphors too much, if they'd pulled at a few of those strings firmly enough at the time, rather than kind of bankrolling the team, sponsoring the team and obviously garnering whatever publicity they were getting from Armstrong's run of success. I mean, you know, they benefited from what Armstrong did as well. I mean, it was, you know, everyone was... you know, everyone was wallowing in gravy at the time, not just Lance Armstrong. So it's a, you know, the sport obviously took a very hard, the punishment that was handed out in terms of a life ban. I certainly think, you know, you could make a case for saying that he shouldn't be entitled to work with athletes, particularly young athletes, in the future, and unless there was a sort of real and obvious kind of attempt at rehabilitation. But, you know, working in the media, I can't really see, you know, banning him just, you know, creates a story from a different perspective. And like you said at the beginning, Rich, I can't imagine, although the Giro wouldn't say so, I can't imagine they'd be too disappointed that Lance Armstrong is creating headlines about the Giro and about the Giro start in Israel, whether or not he's inside the ropes, inside the bubble or not, he's still going to be there. He's still going to be creating quite a bit of noise.
My guess is there'll be journalists who now go to the Giro in Israel because Lance Armstrong will be there.
Well, if you are an adeptee of the sort of Oscar Wilde philosophy of any publicity being good publicity, then with Israel, between Israel, Chris Froome and Lance Armstrong, you know, they've done a cracking job, haven't they, RCS?
Yeah. Well, it's going to give us plenty to talk about when we're there and afterwards, isn't it?
Looking ahead to the Giro, I think you've got us a little interview, Daniel, that will allow us to start to look ahead to the Giro.
I have, Rich. And one of the Giro contenders who's been pretty quiet this spring has been Esteban Chavez, the Mitchelton Scott climber from Colombia. He has been in Colombia the last few weeks at altitude, training for the Giro, training for his assault on the general classification. And I caught up with him, had a quick chat with him on the phone this week. Esteban, we all saw at the Vuelta Oro y Paz the kind of profile and the kind of fame and the adulation that you guys enjoy in Colombia. How difficult is that when you go back to Colombia, that you're this, you know, obviously you're this hero, and how hard is it not to get distracted?
Yeah, it's a tricky. You can be like a mom and be just in one place, or be like a pope, you know. You also need to get involved with the people, and at one point it's easy to cross the line, but always it's good back at the place where you're born. You have your friends, you have your roots, you have your family, and I think this is important. They help you for relieve all the stress out. but also you can cross in the line and go for Paris and, you know, or maybe drinks or too much dinners or whatever. So always you need to find a balance. It's like in life, you need to have a balance in everything.
And so this Giro, Esteban, are you going to win it? Is that the goal, or podium, or top five, or?
Well, that is hard to say. We present Mitchelton in this Euro with a strong team, and we will try for do the best result like a team. Not just I can't talk for myself. You just see the team all this year going really well since January until Flèche Wallonne. We have a really good result. We are protagonists. We are in the front. So I can't tell jokes for myself. We are a strong team, and I'm happy for support a team, you know, like a team. I can't tell jokes for myself. This is not one individual sport. This is one team sport. So we will try for do the best one in just our classification like a team.
Esteban Chavez there talking from Colombia, where he's been training. And you mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I think, Daniel, the effects of fame, or the possible effects of fame, on some of these guys, and the Colombians in particular, where obviously the fans are crazy for cycling and he will be a national figure. How is that, I wonder, when he goes back home? I think you asked him about that.
Well, yeah, I was curious about that as well, Rich, partly picking up on a couple of things that Matt White said when he came over to see us. And that's the Mitchelton Scott director sportif, Matt White, when he came over to see us at Christmas for a couple of events. You know, we talked about obviously the kind of adulation that Chavez has been subject of in the last couple of years, and this sort of hero worship that prevails in Colombia. And I did ask Chavez how he copes with that generally, and also about the struggles he faced last year. Last year was a terrible year for him in that he lost a very good friend. His personal physiotherapist died very young in the summertime, and that sort of cast a cloud over his Tour de France. And then he came back and struggled through the Vuelta a España as well, and he's had a few crashes as well at the start of this season. So I also asked him about dealing with setbacks.
Yeah, it's a tough season last year, and a lot of things happen, so you need to stop it and start again. You learn a lot for a season like this. Probably you learn more the seasons like last season, the 2 years ago. Because when you have a really successful thing, you don't stop for thinking why. But when you have a bad season, you stop and thinking, why this happened, and you learn a lot. And not just me, all the people around me, the team, and everyone learn. Hopefully that helps for the seasons coming, you know?
The one thing about Chavez, Daniel, is the suspicion that his Achilles heel is time trialing, and there's a prologue or an opening time trial in Jerusalem. You know, there's, you know, it might only be seconds, but it could be fistfuls of seconds in 9.7 kilometres that Chavez could lose. And then there's a time trial at the start of the final week. Not, it looks rolling from the profile, sort of lumpy-ish, but not the sort of terrain I would expect Chavez to go that well on. 34.5 kilometres that time, and that's the sort of place where he could give away a few places on GC, don't you think?
Well, Lionel, talking about a suspicion that Chavez is not very good at time trialing, it's a bit like a suspicion that you quite like your food. I think it's fairly well established that he's not the best time trialist in the world. But yeah, that is definitely a worry, not just for him, but the other Mitchelton Scott leader at the Giro, Simon Yates. And I did ask Chavez what he's been doing with a view to those two time trials in this year's Giro. One bit of good news this year was the excellent time trial you did in Paris-Nice. Tell me a little bit about the work you did on your time trialing in the winter, which is obviously going to be important at the Giro.
Yeah, we tried to spend more time in that bike, because I feel horrible when I can go with the guys for 200 kilometers and arrive at the same time, or maybe put time on them, or maybe they put a little bit of time, but in 1:04 for 3 minutes, they put 5 minutes in me. So this is shit. Yeah. So we tried to improve in that, spend more time in that bike. We went in the wind tunnel for make better the position. And yeah, I think the more important is not about the wind tunnel. The wind tunnel now make you going like super fast. You have one position, and the more important is work in that position and believe and do time trials, you know? Sometimes you forgot that and you just ride your road bike. And we take the TT bike and do like time trials, try to do similar parkours like the Giro d'Italia. And this is it, what we're doing. Keeping simple, which the simple things in life is the best.
Well, Daniel, slight signs earlier this season that Chavez might be getting a little bit better. He was 10th in the time trial at in Paris-Nice at Saint-Étienne, only 18.4 kilometres, that one, half a minute down. Unfortunately for him, behind pretty much everyone that he would have needed to be in front of. So probably a bit of work still to do.
Well, it's interesting with the Colombians, though, isn't it? You know, we've talked many times about this fantastic emerging stage racer or generation of stage racers, and Miguel Angel Lopez is sort of the name on everyone's lips at the moment, especially after the Tour of the Alps last week. I conducted a bit of a Twitter poll last week. Who did people think was the Colombian most likely to be the next Colombian Grand Tour winner? And Lopez was the most popular answer, followed by Quintana, and then Chavez and Urán were very much in third and fourth position, quite a long way further back.
No Egan Bernal there.
I think the consensus is that he's probably a couple of years away. Sky's plan for him this year is that he does the Vuelta, am I right in thinking?
I think so, yeah.
So I would suggest that Bernal is maybe a little bit green at this stage, but who knows?
Who knows indeed. Well, I think we're going to hear another interview with another Giro contender next week, aren't we?
We are.
We'll not give away who that is, but he might be somebody quite close to Chavez.
He might be.
Who I think is a real dark horse for the Giro, but we can talk about that next week.
But finally, Rich, what a cracking quote that was from Chavez. You can either live like a monk or live like the Pope. Which one are you, Napalm?
I live like a punk or a mope. I live like a mope.
That's certainly true.
You definitely live like a mope.
That's certainly true. I don't live like either. What about you, Daniel?
I'm very much a monk. Very much a monk.
Okay.
so much so that I refer to my apartment as the monastery. But anyway.
I've got an image of him just brewing beer in the dark, getting up very early.
Well, there's white smoke coming out of my chimney, so I better go now and take care of some business. We'll leave it there. We'll join you next week for our last podcast before the Giro, which is exciting, and the return of the familiar Amaraterra music, of course, which we look forward to as well. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Jonathan Rowe.